So we're now just waiting for the final clearance from the audiovisual people to let us know that they've been able to separate the two components of our talks this morning. But I wanted to give a quick story. So when I was first introduced into coaching soccer, which I did for 19 years, when I had five-year-old soccer players, we would gather both teams into the middle of the field. We would then point at the goal and say, "Whose goal is that?" And one team would raise their hand, but inevitably there were some on the other team that would raise their hands too. So by the end of that, which goal are we going to? Pretty much most of them were oriented. So far, I've had a number of people say, "So which room is which?" So I may ask you all to stand up and point at the room you intend to be in. So one more time. On that side, the far side of that wall, is ballroom C. That's where the residents are about to start talking. This is ballroom A. This is where these people want to be if they want to hear our speakers on Tomorrowland. So, ballroom C for residents, ballroom A for our guest speakers. It does not say that on the papers, so don't rely on your paper. Okay, so the final announcement will be when the audiovisual people give me the thumbs up, then I will turn this room over to Jason. Have we got it? We're good? Okay, Jason, I'll turn this ballroom over to you. This is ballroom A.
Thank you for allowing that juxtaposition over there. I'd like to introduce Carter Dredge. Carter is a good friend of mine who serves as assistant vice president over at Intermountain Healthcare over transformation. I'm the lecturer out at Cornell in the Ivy League. For Carter, I think the best statement I can make about him is that IHC trusts him so much that they lent him out to the state of Arkansas as they're going through Medicaid transformation to be able to be a thought leader to help them through that process and also to help the people of Utah benefit from seeing a state go through that transformation before we had to experience it. But they felt confident enough in Carter to be able to pay him to go there to be a free asset to the state of Arkansas that it felt so strong that he'd be an asset for us at IHC as well as the state of Utah. So with that, I'll welcome Carter Dredge to the stage.
Thank you, Jason. All right. So, so we're going to talk about future healthcare payment models, a topic near and dear to my heart. I could nerd out on this stuff all day. Like I said, I've worked in some venture-backed companies in different parts. We went and took an entire state through this in the state of Arkansas. We're doing it in the state of Utah. And in many of the train's left the station on a lot of this. And we're going to cover some core foundational elements of payment reform so that you can be familiar with where things are headed and why to be able to structure this. In a way, it's going to make the changes in healthcare actually accelerate, and we'll talk about why these things need to occur. So with that, we'll kind of go through it. So I'm going to make a premise that there is a critical need to transform both healthcare delivery and healthcare payment. There's a lot of articles. I'm not going to go through everything. Like I said, I teach a course in the graduate school at Cornell University in New York. If you want a whole bunch of articles, we can give it to you. But we're going to go through just a couple basic fundamental concepts as it relates to healthcare payment transformation. First, when you look at the data related to what we're going to call population utilization, the rate at which a service is done, not necessarily the efficiency of the service, but the rate at which it's done. If you guys want some good reading, the Dartmouth Atlas group is great stuff. Some people may say put you to sleep. For me, it just jazzes me up, right? I know, I'm kind of weird that way. But every one of these green dots is a metropolitan statistical area, like a different major area. And this axis over here, the ranges from 1 to 10, is the rate per 1,000 that a Medicare beneficiary gets a spine surgery, okay? This is after for controlling for comorbidities, age, gender, socioeconomic status, anything from a structural data we can basically do, and we see huge variations. So, in other words, in some parts of the country, Medicare beneficiaries get spine surgeries to the rate of 1.7 per 1,000, while at the same time, others get it over 9 per 1,000. Again, After adjusting for age, gender, comorbidities, etc., it has led some cynics to talk about the likelihood of you getting surgery on your back is more a function of where you live than the condition of your back. Okay? Now, they talk about different cultural, each city, state, culture, regions have different practices in medicine. But the reason we point some of this out, not to necessarily say inherently variation is bad, but there is a lot of it. This is one example of many. But the idea is our current payment systems in the United States do not adequately address how to tackle variation of this type. One simple example. Next, I'm going to use the term about what's called intra-episode variation. So this isn't the number of a particular type of procedure. It's when a procedure is done, the cost and the different care pathways. This has to do with 1 through 10 would be 10 different physicians that perform a total knee replacement in the state of Utah, and what percentage of their patients go to a skilled nursing facility after the joint replacement. And so you can see here we have some physicians with about 6 or 7% of their patients go to a skilled nursing facility, and others that are almost 90% that go to a skilled nursing facility. I would mention, again, we've de-identified this for this. Some of these, they're in the same practice. They perform the procedure in the same hospital. Okay, and again, age, gender, comorbidity. This is not like these are not kind of revisions. These are single, unilateral, primary joint replacements. Okay, and the cost variability from depending on where they get discharged, and there's a reason, you know, there's some of the reasons we'll start to call out about why some of this variation exists. The financing systems between a hospital, a physician, and a post-acute care provider, in this case, are all entirely separate, okay? So if a hospital or if a physician sends a patient to a skilled nursing facility, how much does that actually today impact the financial position of that hospital or the physician? Zero, okay? Zero. So the cost structures are siloed out. And because they're siloed, no one's really watching the macro picture. So costs just continue to go up and up and up because of variation that exists that no one has financial accountability for overall. Second point, so population utilization relates to the rate at which a service is done overall. Intra-episode utilization talks about the efficiency once a service is taken on inside that. All right. Well, if we don't think cost is a problem, I love this article. It's old, but it came out of the New England Journal of Medicine. They said, that's fine. We could just basically cover all this shortfall with taxes and raise the top tax bracket to 92%. Okay, now as for me, I don't know if I can live on only 8% of my income. And so we really have got to figure out how to make this more efficient. At Intermountain Healthcare, we got really super serious about looking at these cost trends. We've always been focused on cost, but we need to get even more so. We did a 5-year plan back in 2010 where we said, all right, this was our historical revenue growth trend. The state of Utah has a very low cost of healthcare, very low, relative to the rest of the country, but I don't know anyone that's saying it's already affordable enough, okay? Also, the rate or the trajectory of spending increase continues to go up like the rest of the country. So even if you start from a relatively low absolute position, you're still having cost increases. So when we looked at this historical trend, we said we've got to figure out how to bend the trend. That's kind of the cliche term in the insurance industry of how to make this cheaper. Bend the trend, bend the curve, etc. Okay? So we actually made an explicit commitment as a company to say we're going to take lower rate increases into the market. We need to figure out how our prices can rise at a lower rate. Also, we're going to aggressively figure out how to manage better utilization. And not by a bunch of red tape and a bunch of other insurance types of things, but through evidence and ways that we can provide clinical care in a more efficient way. Anyone want to take a guess of how big that little pizza wedge is between that top green line and that bottom green line? $2.2 billion. Okay? And by the way, we hit that. Okay? So what that means is, absent these interventions, healthcare costs in the state of Utah delivered by Intermountain Health would have been $2.2 billion higher than it was. Now, when we talk to our for-profit counterparts, they're like, you guys are insane. Why would you want to make $2.2 billion less over a five-year period? Or like, the reality is, healthcare revenues are every other business and every other industry's costs. So you want to talk about one reason why payment reform doesn't really start, doesn't really go on? It's like the industry is basically admitting we have a revenue problem. Okay? But the reality is, again, every dollar spent on healthcare is a dollar that someone else from a small business or every other industry has to spend. And if we can get the same outcome for a better, lower cost, we can actually care for more people. This isn't about less care, this is about better care. All right, so we have a number of different options. So there's a lot of critics that could say, the payment system's busted, it's so messed up, or government's messed up. Everyone can be a critic, but it's hard to create, okay? So we're gonna talk about a couple options we have, because again, it's not good enough just to be a cynic. Let's talk about what we're gonna do about it. All right, first option, healthcare's too expensive. Let's just not pay for stuff. Let's just eliminate coverage, all right? Who thinks that's a great option? Okay, I think that's a bad option, okay? Let's just say, you know what? I know it's important, but we just need to save costs, hack. I don't think that's the right approach. Okay, well, we'll maybe still pay stuff, but let's just add on so many prior authorizations and red tape from an insurance perspective that it just becomes really difficult to do anything. Who thinks that's a great option? I don't think it's a great option either, all right? Third, why don't we just pass on costs to consumers? And I'm not talking about a reasonable high deductible health plan. You know, after my presentation, you're going to talk about healthcare consumerism, and I think there's a real benefit to highly structured, high deductible health plans, health saving accounts, so that people can be accountable for that. But we're not talking like, okay, you have a deductible of like $30,000, and you are totally exposed, okay? Basically, there's not a huge difference when you take this option to extreme as eliminating coverage, okay? I think it's a bad option overall. Or here's what it normally does in Medicare right now. Everyone gets a haircut, okay? Everyone gets, it doesn't matter on your quality, doesn't matter anything. We're just gonna basically pay everyone less, 10% less, everybody. Okay, well, that doesn't really discriminate against people who are providing high quality care and people who aren't, all right? Where we as Computer Mountain at, where I'm at, where a lot of the leading experts in this space are at is say, we need to figure out how to transition to pay for value, not just volume. Because the reality, if I go back to that slide that I had, if I can get there, back to that SNF example, the skilled nursing facility, those costs are significant. So if you have someone that, again, the vast majority of their patients go directly home, use outpatient physical therapy, do not get readmitted, versus someone that goes to a skilled nursing facility, ends up getting readmitted, maybe has some functional problems with the plan, et cetera. The cost variation for that same procedure could be like the difference between $20,000 and $60,000 for the exact same thing. But as of today, the payment to those physicians or those surgeons in this particular case is exactly the same. Whereas the cost to society could be 3x. And the only way to make, quote unquote, more money is to simply do more. And it becomes a real dilemma. It becomes a treadmill. That as we continue to hack payments across the board and don't discriminate any type of value, I get that measuring value is really difficult. I get measuring quality is really different. The problem is, until you learn to do that, there's no mechanism other than simply, you do more, you get paid more, period. How many of you have the majority of your practice where you answer just phone calls and texts? You may do it a lot. Why not? You don't get paid to do that. Okay? There could be a lot of things that you probably could handle with a quick phone call more efficiently or an email than a visit. The system doesn't support it, okay? And many other things that we go for. Those are just a few examples. All right, so I'm gonna go on the premise that we need to figure out how to pay for some type of value rather than purely volume as a premise. So you've heard in the past what's called no margin, no mission. Have anyone heard that? You gotta have a little bit of money to be able to continue to fulfill the mission. Well, in the value-based payment world, you're going to start hearing things like no outcome, no income. Okay? A little scary at first, but the reality is things don't have to be perfect. They just have to be better than they are today. So that's where it's headed. All right. If you really want to like totally get into payment reform, there's a couple guys and authors I refer you to. Bob Mechanic and Stu Altman, who come out of Brandeis University in Massachusetts. This is an old article, but I like the way they framed it up nonetheless, where they said, all right, if we could do it differently, what are our main options? And they laid out four main options. They could say, we could recalibrate fee-for-service. So they could say, the reason it's messed up is because all the weights get off and certain things on a specialty care get compensated a lot more than primary care, so we just need to go and redo those weights. A basic CPT code, and we won't go into everything, it has three weights of how it actually determines the payment. It's called RBRVS, the Resource-Based Relative Value Scale. It came out of Harvard in the 80s. That's basically, like we talk about with the AMA and CPT codes, that's what's behind it. Every one of those CPT codes has values and weights, and they're saying, let's go recalibrate all of that. Well, the reality is, it's super complex, and it still doesn't solve some of the fundamental issues around the fact that it's discrete payments that are part of the problem. So, second, pay for performance. So, what we'll do is we'll keep the payment system the same, but then what we'll do is we'll add on certain quality measures. We'll look to say, okay, antibiotic kind of stewardship, and we'll look at the prescribing patterns. We'll look at things to say, this quality standard, and we'll lay it on top of an existing payment. The hard part with that is that then all of a sudden, now you have an entire fee-for-service payment and an entire quality structure that's completely on top of it in a very complex manner. And very likely, it's really hard to incent something that when you're making a decision of either doing a procedure or not that maybe has a payment of $2,000 or $3,000, a small minor change to an incentive is not likely to change behavior. Okay? But it has some advantages. The next two we're going to talk about relate to episodic payment. And again, those other two previously have very weak or if no changes to really control unnecessary utilization, both the population utilization I talked about at the very beginning or intercase utilization. Episodic payment is where you actually then are going to pay for an episode of care. Think of it like a super DRG. So hospitals today get paid a DRG. It's called a diagnosis-related group. Single payment. Whether someone stays in the hospital 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, one payment. Okay? Now, an episode kind of says, well, let's look at the type of their care, and instead of just having a single payment for the hospital, it's going to be like 90 days. For the next 90 days, there's going to be one payment that's going to cover hospitalizations, potential use of post-acute care, prescriptions, readmissions to the hospital, etc. So it's broadening it out. I'll give you an example just in a second. And then global payment has to do with basically, it's called a PMPM, a per member per month. You get paid one lump sum to service all of the person's care needs. It's basically another term for it is capitation. There's quite a few differences between now and the 90s, but there's some people that have been on this for quite a while. The key is the others, they look at utilization. They talk about encouraging integration and quality. However, now that if I was going to re-rate the overall operational feasibility of these based on new technology and everything else, they're also actually easier to implement, okay? The clear winners, and we're going to spend the time talking about these, is episodic or bundled payment. Those terms are used synonymously. Or global payment, which really would take into account Medicare ACOs, like ACOs, shared savings. The actual name of a Medicare ACO is the Medicare Shared Savings Program, and capitation. Again, we're going to boil this down, again, high-level stuff for about this hour that we have together. Okay, episodic and global payment are the clear winners. So if we're going to see payment changes in the country for the next few years, and we are already seeing these are likely the two biggest ones you're going to see. Okay, let's talk just for a second again about cost per person in healthcare. So you could break it down into a simple algebraic equation. Cost per process, processes per episode, episode per person. If you don't control all of those, you really don't control cost. So there's something called squeezing the balloon. And this is what's called, in the past, they've made changes where they basically ratchet down one part of the payment don't control the others, and all the costs move into another sector. Okay? And so you have to really talk about all these. I'll give examples. For example, first, cost per process. What's the cost to take care of someone in the hospital for a day? Okay? An example of a process per episode is the number of days they're actually in a hospital. And then an episodes per person is, did they even go to the hospital in the first place? Okay? The incentive. It's the first one, cost per process, is all about efficiency. Everything you do, is it done efficiently? Okay? The next one is about intra-episode utilization. Is when you're doing an activity in aggregate, how efficient are you in a broader sense? And then again, episodes per person, it's about population utilization. The rate someone gets hospitalized, the rate you do spine surgery, the rate you do a CABG, the rate you do several other types of things, okay? This isn't just procedural, it's just procedural is sometimes easier to wrap your mind around with some of these things, okay? And then overall, if we look at fee-for-service, which is the predominant payment mechanism today, what kind of cost accountability does fee-for-service encourage, okay? Well, it encourages efficiency, okay? I gave it like a little neutral ground about intra-episode because maybe things like DRGs, et cetera. But when you look at it broadly to a bundle, it does zero, okay? And population utilization in terms of the rate of which things are done totally fails miserably, okay? All right, bundle payments still encourages efficiency, begins to encourage, and again, intra-episode utilization efficiency, and but it doesn't necessarily encourage population utilization. In other words, you could get, let's just say if we bundled, say a total knee replacement, which by the way, for Medicare, they've mandated that in markets all over the country, including the Utah market, by the way. So if you're not familiar with, you probably should get familiar. And by the way, you could be in a bundle and not even know it. So chances are some of you may be treating patients in bundled environments already. Okay, and we'll talk about how that works. But it doesn't necessarily, you don't necessarily get fewer bundles, okay? You get more efficient. Last one, it really covers all of them. Efficiency, intra-episode utilization, population utilization, et cetera. We'll give some more examples in a second. Is this making sense from a macro level? Okay? I'm saying if we're really gonna try to figure out how to control costs, we've gotta figure out a way to reward people to do things differently. Here's a poster child example. This is the reason I went back to graduate school at Cornell to change payment. I'm working as a senior financial analyst down in St. George. I'm fresh out of school. I'm working with a bunch of neonatologists, and they said, we came up with a way to keep babies out of the newborn intensive care unit with some advanced forms of surfactant and this air pressure and everything else. It was great. They did this. They didn't send them to the NICU. They did the intervention right in the labor and delivery suite. Boom. We reduced NICU admissions on that target population by 25%. And the hospital lost $300,000. Okay? I'm going to show you examples later today where he said, hey, we figured out a way to engage patients in primary care so they don't go to the ER. How does that financial equation work today? You lose a ton of money. The better you are at keeping people healthy, the worse you get paid. Does that make any sense? To me, that makes no sense. Like, great job, fantastic. Keep going, keep people healthy. Smack, smack, smack financially. Craziness. So for people that are like, dude, payment reform, it scares me. I said, payment reform should not scare you as much as I'm hoping, again, for people that want to figure out a way to make things more efficient and not get totally penalized, it can make it go faster. That's the key piece. How many times have you said, I want to do that? I can't tell you how many times I hear this question. Hey, how come we don't do that? That looks really like that would make a lot of sense. There's no CPT code. Man, we could do that. Does it pay anything? Well, would it work? Yeah, I think it's worked. I think it would work great. But there's no code. And because there's no code, we're not going to do it. That doesn't make any sense to me. How do we make, here's the thing. I'm a finance guy, but you know what? I want clinical medicine to drive. And I want finance to support. And right now, too many times, finance is wagging the tail of finance is wagging the dog of how stuff gets done. And that's just wrong. Clinical medicine, best evidence-based clinical medicine, needs to lead and finance needs to support. But right now, finance is not being a support. It's being a barrier to best clinical medicine. Sorry, I get like way passionate about this stuff. I'm just like, okay. So, for example, here's a bundled payment cost example. Can I have percentages like, so for a total knee replacement, it gets a discrete thing. It has kind of a typically, it says clear start and end point. So the DRG payment's about $10,000. There's another $500,000 for hospital outpatient if you have some imaging studies, other things like this. These ones are expected costs. If 25% of the time they went to an inpatient rehab, that's going to cost about $20,000. So again, if it's 25%, that's about $5,000. A skilled nursing facility, et cetera. The key point I want to make is when you look at the cost of a total joint replacement, I have all the time hospitals come to me and they say, and I still do a little consulting on the side, and they say, I want to figure out how to make device costs cheaper, and so I want to do a bundle payment. I say, well, okay, the majority of the costs of a bundle are not even in the hospital, okay? And if all you want to do is lower the cost of an implant, you don't need a bundle. You need a gain-sharing program. There's a difference. But the key point is you have to look broader than what you do. And what this is going to do is this is going to inherently change the way we partner. Because people are going to interact with businesses that are not owned by the same company. Because they have all kind of, and again, grown up in these silos for these payments. Okay? It's going to change dramatically. By the way, once they instituted bundles, overall admissions to skilled nursing facilities, inpatient rehabs, LTACs, et cetera, dropped substantially. Because once people realized that they became accountable for all of those costs, they said, it's cheaper to do it in home health or outpatient physical therapy with similar outcomes. So it's changing the patterns. All right, so let's talk about risks and rewards. Risk is about uncertainty. It's about uncertainty of level of spending and clinical outcomes. Risk and rewards go together. As a finance person, when I hear the term risk, I don't think of it as a bad thing. Risk to me doesn't have a negative connotation. Risk is typically about scale. It's about influence and control. Okay? Whoever manages the risk and manages it well earns what's called a risk premium. Okay? So in healthcare, when we talk about risk, there's two main types. There's what's called actuarial risk, the likelihood of someone getting sick or developing cancer or getting hit by a bus, okay? It's a risk that really, it's all about pooling it to a large number. But then there's what's called performance risk, errors, inefficiencies, patient behavior, okay? All right, payment reform is about shifting performance risk to providers with the logic that providers have more control over these risks. So it's not about controlling all of those risks perfectly. The question is, do we, as a clinical delivery component of the health system, rather than the financing system, have ability to influence those factors more than an insurance company? I would argue and say yes. Who is more likely to be able to prevent errors in medicine? An insurance company or a body of physicians and other clinicians working together? Who is more likely to identify and change efficiencies? Who is more likely to potentially influence patient behavior? And not control entirely, but to make a difference? An insurance company or a body of clinicians? I am 100% that clinicians are in a better position to impact these variables. Here's how it works today. The insurance company has all the risk, the providers make the decisions, and they are way disconnected, and therefore you get a lot of red tape because they don't have control, so they have to prior auth everything, okay? Because the people making the decisions and the people paying the bill are not the same. And we have a huge disconnect, and we have huge fights all the time between the two groups. How many times are you like, it doesn't make any sense. Why are they not paying for this? This totally is needed. Well, guess what? They're paying the bill. We're going to mash those together. This is about risk alignment. So it should just say, listen, whoever has the risk makes the decisions on how things happen from a payment perspective. Kind of the reality. So there's a risk transfer, but again, those who manage risk well, it's also a cash transfer. Okay? And I don't have enough time. If I had enough time, I'd put, you know, like a smiley face on the doctor or whatever, you know, things like this. Because it's not just about risk. If you do risk well, you get rewarded. And then you could do it faster, again and again. If every time you came up with an intervention, back to this neonatologist example, you lose hundreds of thousands of dollars, how fast do you improve? There's inherent lags on the how fast we improve in healthcare. Because the biggest improvements we make hurt us financially. And then even if we're driven, there's something in the back of our mind that's like, oh, I could do that another one in another 6 months. Instead of, what if I could do it again in 6 days? Okay? Best organizations in the world would cease to exist as healthcare providers. All right. Okay. Another key concept, why this is so difficult, is the fact that you have to change the way you provide care and the way you get paid at the same time. If you change, if all you do is say, I'm going to do everything I've done today, and all I'm going to do is go out and sign a bunch of risk contracts, okay, right here, I'm going to all of a sudden take on more risks than I can manage. And I'm going to lose my shirt on the deal. If you say, payment reform is bunk. I'm just going to go out and make the best clinical decisions I can, keep people out of the hospital. Where does that value go? Goes to payers. Doesn't go to you. Okay? So the key is, you've got to figure out how to change both. You've got to figure out how to clinically evolve and evolve your payment. And if you do one or the other alone, your business goes in the toilet. This is a simple concept. It is really difficult in real life. But it's a really fundamental principle. Okay? All right. There is huge market schizophrenia on this topic about payment reform. This was something that was done by what's called the Advisory Board, which is a healthcare consulting firm. And they went and asked like some of 76 of the biggest well-known organizations all over the country, Mayo, et cetera. Okay? And they said, all right, what is your revenue, what does your payments look like in 10 years from now? And when you look at this, okay, the lighter the color, the more aggressive the payment reform. So capitation is light, bundle payments, pay performance, dark is fee-for-service. Okay? So just over a quarter said, you know what? Payment reform is a fad. I'm going to ride the fee-for-service horse until it dies on me. Okay? That's about a quarter. Another little over a quarter, they said, I realize there's going to be, we have to change. So I know there may be fewer services in this market. I'm just going to expand my market and everyone is going to fly to me. Like that kind of destination acute site. When I was living in Arkansas, we had, I love Arkansas. But the medical school in Arkansas, which is a great medical school, they were convinced that people were going to fly all over the world to get treatment in there. Now, for multiple myeloma, which they are really, really good at, I could see it. But I don't necessarily see everyone in the world going there to get a total joint replacement. Okay? The fact is, when you talk about domestic tourism, and if you really want to go to this, there's what's called Bertrand competition. It's called the race to the bottom. Because the second it's all about bringing sites in from everywhere, you compete globally. Okay? So if someone's going to fly one state, why not two? If they're willing to fly two states, why not four? If they're willing to fly across the country, why not to India? Okay? It begins to be significant in competition. I got invited back by AAMC, the Association for American Medical Colleges, back in Washington, D.C., because they are freaking out. Because so many of these medical centers, it's almost like they have their head in the sand because they're like, my cost structure is huge. I don't know if I can change it. That's okay. I'm just going to become a destination acute site. Last time I saw Mayo's capital plan expansion, it was like billions of dollars. And I got it from talking to the person from an international finance department. So if you're saying you're going to compete in that space, just know you're competing globally. And it's going to be intense. I don't think for typical local healthcare providers, that is the best strategy. All right. Sorry. Population health managers. These are companies where they say, I'm going to convert most of my payment into a more global type of payment so that I can get rewarded for delivering high quality care. This is the bucket that Intermountain Healthcare is in. This is in the bucket in the other organizations that I've been working in. They're saying, we need to change our payment so we can get paid to help people get and stay healthy. Okay? And then there's this last group where they're like, we don't even know the heck what we want to do. Okay? Now, the reality is, when you're converting from fee-for-service to population health type of paradigm, it feels like you're here. But the question you should have as a practice or as an organization is, does it feel like you're here because you're transitioning from here to here? Or does it feel like you're here is because you don't have a clear strategy? Because those are extremely different value propositions. Okay? All right. Okay, there are barriers to adopting payments. One, individual initiatives create what's called first mover disadvantages. Whoa, a normal business term is talks about first mover advantages. What's a first mover disadvantage? I'll explain. Let's say there's a local insurance company that says, you know what? You're doing awesome stuff. You're keeping people out of the ER. I'm going to pay you to keep people out of the ER. Okay? So every time you keep someone out of the ER, we'll look at the aggregate cost, and if you save $100,000, I'll cut you a check for $50,000. It's called a shared savings agreement. Okay? But now let's just say the fact is that every other payer, but let's just say now when you change a process, you don't just change it for one part of your business. You say, I do this for everybody. Okay? So every other insurance company that doesn't pay you to keep people out of the ER, of that $100,000, how much do they keep? All of it. $100,000. And then guess what they do? They undercut the insurance company that's trying to pay you differently and steal their membership. Because they made $50,000 more, they can afford to have a lower premium in the market. And so the person, the good guys who are trying to pay for value, what happens to them? They get beat up in the market. Okay? First mover disadvantages. Okay? Reach a tipping point. Same example. But let's just say they said, I'm going to pay you because you're going to keep people out of the ER. But let's just say this insurance company only makes up 5% of your business. You look at your panel, and you're like, that's only 5% of my patients have this insurance. Are you going to change what you do on 100% of patients, a little bit different side of the same coin, for only 5%? Probably not. And let's just say we have a provider group that's super engaged. They're like, I'm on board. I want to do bundle payments. Pay me differently. And you go to talk to Regents or Select or whatever and say, pay me differently. And they're like, you are one practice of thousands. I can't just change it for you. There's not enough scale. That's why as a market, we have to have all the insurance companies particularly working together from a model, not payment rates, but a model. And we have to have all of our providers working together to get this, make this happen. That's why in the state of Arkansas, when it was brokered by the governor's office, they said, we're all going to negotiate individual rates, but we're all going to be on a common model. Because otherwise, we have free riders that will make the problem very difficult. So again, and then we had, when people wanted to do it, everyone wanted their own definition. Everyone wanted, this is in, this is out, because there's exceptions. I mean, you could say, so if someone is pregnant, or if someone is HIV positive, or if someone has this comorbidity, take them out, because they're an outlier. Okay, that's great. But if every single time you make a bundle, it's different, the scale is just too complex. So we have to get standardization here. In short, there's free riding, not enough critical mass to make a difference, and complexity. But the reality is all of these problems can be solved through strategic leadership. And it's up for us as progressive leaders in this space to figure out how to make it happen so we can continue to go faster in the way that we make biggest and most important patient care advances. All right. So in summary, if you move to population health management, which is another word of combining advanced clinical delivery and payment reform, people use it in different ways, you need to do the following. You need to manage the full spectrum of a member's health, not just a slice. That doesn't mean every person has to manage the full thing, but as large organizations or people looking at it, you have to look broader than just the pieces you do. Okay? Accept financial risk to a broader degree, otherwise you won't have the financial resources to continue. Significantly increase the level of evidence-based high-value care. We have a lot of good evidence-based care, but when you look at it, there's a lot of things too that happen today that there's no evidence for. And then we need to figure engage with patients, clinicians, and other partners. Many other non-traditional healthcare partners. By the way, just as a quick stat, the biggest bundled payment risk holders in the country are not even healthcare providers. Okay? There are these large-scale venture and private equity firms that say healthcare has been kind of like super archaic. There's been a lot of cumbersome regulation, And with these payment reforms coming in, they see huge disruption and they're taking risk positions, knowing that things are going to change pretty fast. Because anytime you see a change in payment or a change in regulation, you see market opportunities and stones that you turned over that you never could look at before. Because legally you couldn't do it, but now you can. All right, so let's talk about some of the mechanics. We talked about the theory. How does this actually work? Okay, so steps 1, 2, and 3 is how stuff happens today. Patient seeks care, providers submit a claim, everyone gets paid. Great, that still happens under these payments too, except they have 3 other steps. They identify who's primarily responsible. I don't have time to go through all the details, but the idea is for each episode or for each thing, they say, who's the one who's primarily accountable? They call it, in Arkansas, we call it the principal accountable provider. Then they evaluated their cost and quality, and then they said, we're either gonna save money, share savings, or they're gonna pay us back for some things. Here's an example. Again, let's take a simple example of a total joint replacement, because again, I believe Medicare, this is gonna be the way they pay for this. In Arkansas, Arkansas Blue Cross Blue Shield, which has like a 70% commercial market share, this is the way they pay for total joints statewide. Okay? Every one of these blue bars is an orthopedic surgeon. These cost thresholds about acceptable, commendable, and gain sharing limit, I'll talk about in the next slide. But the idea is, this is the average cost per episode. So someone could have done 100, some could have done 50. There's exclusions that if you do less than a certain number, you're not calculated, etc. But here's how it works. When they originally set these thresholds, they set it at the 85th percentile. And they said that first acceptable threshold. So if your costs are in the top 15% on this procedure, when they originally said that, the difference between how much your costs were and that top line of the acceptable threshold, they said you're going to pay us back because you are way too costly in the market. Okay? They had stop-loss thresholds and things like this. It's not a zero-sum game. Once they set these thresholds, they fixed it to a dollar amount, so you're not chasing your tail where it's always 85, 85, 85. It's 85%, and then going forward, as long as you're below that threshold, you're good. It's not a zero-sum game. Everyone onto this could generate shared savings, okay? So, and they don't want your cash flow problems to be the insurance company's cash flow problems, so they do what's called a clawback provision. They just pay you less in the future until they get the money back. Okay? It's called a clawback. Second, if it was between the 85th percentile and the 50th percentile, no change. No change. No shared savings, no shared losses. If you're below the 50th percentile, that commendable threshold, they will cut you a check of the difference of 50% between where this line is and where your cost performance is. Because they're saying, you're efficient, you're high quality, and there's a whole bunch of quality stuff behind this that I'm not showing. I'm just trying to go straight to the heart of how these work. So, just to put it as maybe an example, if this was $20,000, and say this is $40,000, and this was $35,000, this particular surgeon would have to pay $2,500 back per case. Okay, overall. Now, you could sell off that risk. Large healthcare systems could indemnify those physicians and say, boom, we're all working together. As long as we partner on this, we'll take, you have no downside risk. There's so many different types of physician payment models that are out there. Many under the sun you could think about. But the reality is these models are coming into the market pretty substantially. Second, if you were, again, this is 35 and 20, you come in at 30, no change. If you come in at 15 and that's 20, they cut you a check for $2,500 every time you do a case on top of your pro fee. That's how the model works. One of many. I'm not saying it's the best model. I'm saying it's a model that's live statewide in the U.S. All right. So I'm going to talk a little bit about measurement again. This is Clayton Christensen. He's a Harvard business professor and he's on the board at Intermountain. It says, because of the way we measure things, it doesn't make sense to do what makes sense. And some people read that like, that doesn't make any sense. I'll give you an example. All right, how do we measure success? Miles per gallon. Little economy car, sports car, 18-wheeler, or train. If we look at miles per gallon, the economy car is king. And the diesel and the 18-wheeler and the train, those are dogs, man. Those are horrible. But what if I told you I wasn't measuring miles per gallon? I was measuring ton miles per gallon. The train and the 18-wheeler are rock stars. So if it's not just about moving from point A to point B, it's about moving stuff from point A to point B. Okay? I'm telling you, with new payment reform, the metric unit of analysis of success just changed. Because today, it's all about how much volume you can crank through. The more you do, the more you get paid. It's all about the economy car. In the future, if it's about keeping people as healthy as possible, some things that may be kind of like the dogs, if you will, of certain types of things in the future are going to be the trains of tomorrow. It's a simple analogy, but it's for real. Okay? All right. Let me give you a simple example from the space where I'm in now with talking about home care stuff. A dollar spent on some mobility, durable medical equipment, maybe a shower chair or walker, could potentially prevent $17 in fall-related costs. Okay? A dollar spent on supplemental oxygen could avoid $10 in COPD complications. Oh, and a dollar spent on CPAP therapy could potentially avoid $7 in OSA complications. Okay, Medicare ratcheted these prices down so much, the majority is, if you're a Medicaid member or an unfunded person, the incentive for you to service that patient today could be zero. But if you stint that care, don't provide it, the fact is, you could be paying big time on the back end, and then in the end, when you are financially at risk, you could be spending money back. Simple example. Let me give you a more complex example. Larger scale primary care. Intermountain did, and this, we published this in JAMA last year. This is an extensive program for medical home model and embedded mental health integration where we do behavioral health in the primary care setting. For those areas that did this extremely, the ones that were really routinized, we saw 30% reduction in emergency room visits. We saw a 14% reduction of hospital admissions. So this is all ceteris paribus, all things being equal. Okay? We saw PCP visits go up. We saw urgent care visits go up. Specialty visits were roughly flat. Lab tests down. Radiology tests down. Prescription use up. Presumably as a function of adherence. Okay. So by all intents and measures, we substituted out people that were using higher acuity care for people who are using primary care. In many cases, this is exactly what we want to achieve as a clinical community. Okay? Here's what the financials looked like. So overall, for patients that receive care in this model, for all everybody, we saved about $115 per patient per year. Okay? For those that had a lot of comorbidities, we saved a whole lot more than that. Okay? So we spent about $22 per member per year. We saved $115, 5x return. What did this look like on our financial statements? We lost millions of dollars, millions on this program. Okay? Crazy. They're not going to the ER anymore. They're not going to the hospital as much as anymore. They're taking their appropriate medications. Other certain ancillary tests have been reduced. This is like a win, and it's a financial loser under the current payment model. Craziness. I'd highly encourage you to read the article on this in JAMA, Association of Team-Based Care with the Changes in Utilization. There's a two-page editorial article that gives you the gist of it without all the technical kind of back and forth. All right. So I know it's a little cliche, we're talking about building the bridge, okay? Going from where we're at today in fee-for-service to a population health management world. One, we have to make sure we have sound evidence in everything we do. Two, we can't be naive and think just that we have a standard, it means it's always followed. We have to have mechanisms that ensure every time it happens. This is electronic medical records and a bunch of other stuff. Second, we have to have a robust primary and mental health care base to take care of people at that front line in fundamentally critical ways. We have to have capabilities in telehealth to engage with people all throughout, not just face-to-face, in person, as has historically been the traditional norm. We have to have a process of how we continually improve our processes and have enough analytics to see beyond our four walls, to see broader, to see the total episode, to see the total cost. We have to be able to provide education at the patient's preferences to them, not just when they're in the office. We have to have physician payment models. Healthcare systems could go out, negotiate this risk, and then just have those savings. And you could say, well, I don't want a physician payment model. Fine. But then you don't get access to the value when you create value. Okay? We have to have those. All right? We have to have a robust home care type of service delivery because there's a lot of stuff there. When you look at the Utah market, those services are expected to go up 30% in the next 3 years. We have to have pricing and transparency that when someone's ordering a test or anything else, you could see. It's going to be transparent for patients, which I'm assuming the next speaker is going to talk about. It's going to be transparent to providers, which is, by the way, all of this with payment reform means everyone's going to have the data. So they're going to see all the costs for the people involved in the care. Second, you better change the way you buy stuff, capital budgeting. If the payment mechanisms are changing, you better change the way you buy and build stuff. Okay? Health promotion and wellness. How do we keep people active, healthy, preventative? There's going to be the launch of new insurance products that are on this kind of genre. Utilization management, and not the utilization management and the dirty word of the prior authorizations and the red tape, but founded on evidence-based medicine and continuous improvement in analytics. Also, benefit design. How do we reward patients and customers as they engage with the healthcare system to be financially incentivized? Same thing about shared decision making. Every one of these boxes we could talk about for hours. But the reality is we're going to need to have them all together. Integrated care management. How do we coordinate that? How do we have seamless pathways between when we go through different sites of care? Again, do we have to change our management structure to look at things more geographically based rather than just a silo for each one? Oh, and by the way, we have to figure out how to get paid for it. So I've been talking about one box, by and large, of an entire bridge that needs to be built as we change healthcare. Again, so as I kind of conclude, why should we transform healthcare payment? Because the permit payment system we have makes improvement too slow. People are harmed. And the people who are the most progressive get the most penalized. If you want something to go fast, do we want to entirely have it work just by on the whim of that they might get a little bit of a grant to do something new? Or do we want to encourage the entire engine to say, this is how we want to provide care? Because to me, patient care is king. My mom was in a wheelchair for 40 years. She was homebound for over a decade. And the reality is there was a lot of times when there was very little financial incentive to serve my mom. But the reality is all of our patients deserve the best care that we can. Resources are not limitless, and therefore resources are spent where returns are generated. And if it was up to me, and I'm trying to do something about this, but it's not just a one person, it's an entire community thing, I think it makes sense to have resources spent on what keeps people healthy versus otherwise. So, if we end this up, we've been on this road. It's been rocky. It's been a dirt road. Okay? We're now getting on this road. We have models, live, different states, here in Utah, et cetera. The reality is we need to be able to handle traffic on this kind of road. Okay? There's a big difference from where we're at today and where we need to be. And it's all of our job as leaders in this industry to make sure we do not end up on this road. Okay? This is what we do not want. Okay? So with that, that's kind of what I have. I probably only have just a minute or two for questions, but I'm happy to talk afterwards. So thank you very, very much for your time and attention.